As our world becomes increasingly interconnected, so do the risks we face. But with the right context, we can uncover deeper meaning. Moody's decodes risk so that you can act with confidence. Visit Moody's.com to see how your organization can decode risk and unlock opportunity.
The Economist.
Hello, and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm Aura Okunbiyi.
And I'm Jason Palmer. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world.
The pandemic and the popularization of working from home transformed many people's family lives in some form or another, marriages in particular. Some American couples have adapted rather flexibly. Meet the remote husband.
And killer whales didn't get that nickname without reason. They engage in brutal, coordinated hunts. What's truly amazing is that their vicious techniques are passed down through the generations. Violent though it is, that is a hallmark of culture. First up, though.
In early April, I was out in the forest near the Dutch town of Ermelo, watching 70 young men and women crawling through the mud and firing blanks from their assault rifles.
Matt Steinglass is our deputy Europe editor.
They were taking part in the Dienjaar, or service year, a new program that lets young Dutch sign up for a year-long trial in the armed forces rather than the regular four-year enlistment term.
And you're learning a lot about yourself.
It's a fun experience, good experience. You learn things. Maybe it's not for you, maybe it is. That's where you can find everything out.
Do you think that the Dienjaar is upcoming? That it's more becoming more popular, but I'm not sure.
Most of the recruits seemed to find it challenging, but they were also having fun. Sergeant Major Ivo Samsin is one of the program's trainers. He says a lot of young people are missing structure in their lives, which the military is good at giving them.
At the moment in the Netherlands, both parents have a job, so the child will stay behind alone at home, and he had to arrange all the structure by himself.
The Dienjaar program is a big success. It's drawing far more applicants than it has spots, and the government plans to scale it up next year from 625 places to 1,000. But it barely begins to solve the Netherlands' recruitment problems. The Dutch armed forces number 49,000, which is less than a fifth of their size during the Cold War, but 1 in 10 of their positions is vacant. And this is not just a problem in the Netherlands. Europe is experiencing its largest war since 1945, but military recruiters can't seem to attract enough new volunteers. Their campaigns, centered on patriotism and shared values, are a good start, but they aren't doing the trick.
Wir stehen für Frieden in Deutschland, Europa und der Welt.
Lots of things can give you confidence for a little while. But confidence that lasts a lifetime? There's one place you'll find that.
To fill out the ranks of their armed forces, some countries are thinking about bringing back conscription, registering all of their 18 or 19-year-olds, and taking as many as they need.
So, Matt, you've made clear there are just not enough people signing up. Why is that? Why are recruiters having such a hard time?
One reason is that young people have grown averse to fighting, even in defensive wars. There's a global survey called the World Values Survey, which goes around the world asking people a long list of questions every few years. And in the most recent round of questioning, when they asked people, would you be willing to fight for your country? They got very low levels of enthusiasm. In Germany, they get 42% of 16 to 29-year-olds saying yes. In Japan, it's 9% who say that they're willing to fight for their country. In the Netherlands, it's 36%. You see this kind of lack of enthusiasm for fighting for your country all over the world.
So how to explain that lack of enthusiasm then?
Some political scientists say this is to be expected. As countries get richer, people tend to become less willing to make sacrifices for the nation, more focused on individualism and personal self-exploration and self-fulfillment. But that doesn't explain a lot of the differences that you see. So for example, in France, 58% of young people say they would be willing to fight for the country. One way to think about it is that there are historical differences. The countries that lost World War II tend to have very low enthusiasm for fighting for their country. In Spain and Portugal, there were military dictatorships for decades, which led at least part of the population to become unenthusiastic about the military. And the opposite can also be true. If you have a conflict in your region or some recent reason to remind you that you want to fight, then you're more likely to want to fight for your country. So, for example, in wealthy countries like Taiwan, South Korea, and Israel, which have immediate security threats, you see quite high willingness to fight for your country, 70% or more. There's also an economic issue. Right now, in a lot of countries, youth unemployment is very low, and that makes it hard for the armed forces to compete just as an employer. You have rising wages. The level of youth unemployment in Germany is actually below 6%. And militaries are not famous for being high-paying employers, so they're unlikely to be able to compete on salary. There is one very interesting phenomenon in Europe, which people call the Nordic exception. The Nordic countries, Denmark, Finland, Norway, and Sweden, all have very high willingness to fight. People in those countries tend to think of the armed forces as their armed forces. There's a high willingness to sacrifice for national goals. There's a lot of social cohesion in those countries. But the reason why those countries, which are all expanding their armies, are not having trouble finding soldiers is that all four of them have conscription.
Now, when you say conscription, what do you mean by that, Matt? You mean press-ganging people into the military, or you mean like a kind of national service where you do it for a year or two?
The way it works in Nordic countries is basically the latter. They take the whole class of 19-year-olds, they have them fill out a questionnaire to see whether they're suitable for the military, and then they pick about a tenth of them to actually go and serve for about a year. It involves some training. There's actually some competition in some places to get into the military because not everybody gets picked. So it's seen as somewhat prestigious. It can look good at on your CV. And it seems to make young people more enthusiastic about the military rather than less enthusiastic. I spoke with Paul Jonsson, who's the defense minister of Sweden, and he said that about 80% of the conscripts, after they've served their stint, say that they would recommend it to other people. Afterwards, something like 30% re-enlist in the military as soldiers or reserves, which helps to increase the number of contract soldiers, professional soldiers who you really need to staff up your professional army. And it means that the armed forces in the Nordic countries are still a melting pot for different classes rather than turning into something that only the working class does. It prevents political polarization. You see in a lot of volunteer armies that only right-wing people tend to go into the army. And you can even have problems like what they've had in Germany where you get neo-Nazi cells inside your armed forces. And a lot of countries outside of Europe as well have adopted conscription largely as a way to fuse their societies together. In the United Arab Emirates, they introduced conscription in 2014. They felt they needed to forge a sense of national identity. And Morocco, Jordan, and Kuwait have done the same.
And you hinted that even more countries are considering employing conscription.
Yes, the idea has been raised again in Germany and in Britain recently. It's not clear how seriously it's being considered at the political level, but it's definitely come up. You see in Ukraine, for example, that they have had to lower the age of military conscription because they're not getting the level of volunteers that they got at the beginning of Russia's invasion. It's also important to explain that the kind of conscription you get in Western countries is quite different from what you see in countries like North Korea, where everyone is simply signed up and press-ganged into the army, or in Russia, for that matter, where it's much more coercive.
Well, getting away from the sort of extreme cases, there's a tension here. You say that people are resistant to signing up, and there's still going to be this push for conscription. That sounds like a recipe for some trouble.
Conscription along the lines of what they do in Nordic countries is not so much of a hurdle, because you're taking a relatively small percentage of the cohort of 18 or 19-year-olds. And people who don't want to do it can always give answers on the questionnaires that make it likely that they'll be disqualified. Two-thirds of people in Sweden, for example, fill out the questionnaire in such a way that they won't be considered for the draft. And that's fine. The military doesn't need people who don't want to serve. And if some people want to self-select out, that will work as well. To some extent, it just foregrounds the idea of volunteering for people who otherwise wouldn't be thinking about that as an important option at the end of high school.
But I guess the question is whether conscription is just necessary to cover the shortfall in armed forces that you described at the start.
It does look like conscription may be on the menu for a lot of countries. Young people in the West value choice. They value self-actualization. That's great. But they may have an inaccurate sense that they live in a very safe world. They don't. People in Ukraine thought that they would never have to fight for their country either. And it turned out they did.
Thanks very much for your time, Matt.
Thank you, Jason.
As our world becomes increasingly interconnected, so do the risks we face. But with the right context, we can uncover deeper meaning. Moody's decodes risk so that you can act with confidence. Visit Moody's.com to see how your organization can decode risk and unlock opportunity.
Picture the scene. A couple living together in Southern California's sun-drenched Orange County. She's working in the local office of a major law firm, while he's working from home, employed by a tech startup based 400 miles away. On the east coast of the United States in Massachusetts, another couple. He's writing code from their apartment while she goes to study at nearby Harvard. Take another couple. He's working remotely for a tech company, and she's a doctor. It's all indicative of a new trend emerging across America, where it's the men who are staying at home to work.
The rise of the remote husband is a trend that largely I began noticing among my peers.
Alice Forward is our Wall Street correspondent and co-host of Money Talks, our weekly podcast about business and finance.
It seems that among, you know, well-educated and relatively well-off couples, the decision about where they lived has been increasingly based on the area in which it was best for the woman to work. And that's because often their husbands were in jobs that could be fully remote. And for me, this conjured up quite a funny image, which is that, you know, when the wives are going out to work every day in offices, classrooms or hospitals, they are waving goodbye to their husbands who are remaining at home, a sort of inverse of what happened in the 1950s. Now, obviously, this isn't just a gender swapped 1950s revival. The men are still working rather than just spending their time cooking, cleaning or looking after children, though I'm sure they do a bit of that as well. But this trend, sort of rise of the remote husband in the US at least, is happening for a very modern reason. And it is because of the shift to widespread remote working in general.
Why is the trend in America leaning towards men working remotely and not women?
Yeah, so this is actually happening for a reason that we all already understand and know quite well, right? Which is that men and women still specialize in different kinds of work. So jobs in industries like computer science, engineering, those are disproportionately done by men. Things like teaching and nursing roles are still sort of dominated by women. And also, if you look at professions like law or medicine, they do still employ slightly more men than women. But actually, that's shifting quite quickly. So more women than men are now enrolled in law school and medical school. That means that, you know, among younger couples, it's more likely that it's the woman who is going to become a lawyer or a doctor than the man.
And how exactly does the different types of work that the genders specialize in affect how able they are to work from home?
Yes, this also gets to something that I think is also quite familiar. You know, if there's a poster child for a city sort of hollowed out by remote work, it's got to be San Francisco because tech workers could work from home so easily. But of course, this varies a lot across all kinds of occupations. So, you know, the vast majority of medical professionals, for instance, have to treat patients in person. And lawyers can be sort of limited to a specific geographical area by their license or specialty. But if you work in coding, tech, architecture, engineering or business, those are the jobs that surveys seem to find allow people to work fully remotely. So around half of people working in computer or mathematical jobs can work remotely full time.
Alice, I'm not going to lie, I'm still surprised that we aren't seeing a similar rise in the remote wife.
because there are still gender gaps in occupation, because far more men do tech jobs than women do, and far more tech jobs are fully remote, when you look at a population level, it appears that it's sort of much easier for men to work from whatever location they choose. There was a big survey by a consultancy called McKinsey, and they found that 38% of working men had the option to work remotely full-time compared to just 30% of women. Meanwhile, roughly half of women said they're unable to work remotely at all compared to just 39% of men.
Sounds like women are being given the short end of the stick, if you ask me. Or is there more to it than that?
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure that they are. Obviously, it's sort of nice to be able to choose where you work from and whether you work fully remotely. But certainly for women who are married or in long-term partnerships, though of course that doesn't apply to everyone, I think this actually is sort of a very positive trend, because there are all sorts of compromises that couples make when living together. And there are huge advantages for that couple if only one spouse is geographically tied down. You know, and it's easy to think of hypothetical examples here, say that sort of the wife is offered a huge promotion which requires her moving to Chicago. You know, 30 years ago, she probably would have had to turn it down if her husband's job was tied very tightly to New York. But once one partner is geographically liberated, it makes it far easier for the other to climb the corporate ladder, for the woman to sort of take that promotion in Chicago and move her husband and her family there. The Orange County couple that we referenced in the intro picked that area because it was convenient for her job. And also it gave them access to their children's grandparents, who have now taken on some of the childcare duties.
But if more women were allowed to work remotely, what benefits could come with that?
This is a great question, because actually there's been a sort of huge amount of economic research on this. Claudia Goldin, who is an economist at Harvard who won the Nobel Prize last year, has written extensively about how remote work is a good thing for women. So she's analysed sort of female participation in the labour force over the past sort of 200 years. And it's always been at its highest when working from home has been sort of more possible. She's also found that gender wage gaps are the smallest in industries where flexible working is the norm. So things like pharmacy jobs where you can do shift work. And all of that is, you know, still true. So women having more access to remote work or flexible work options would definitely be a good thing as well. That said, I think that this trend sort of reveals something interesting about how it's not just flexible work for women that can actually be to women's advantage. I think that flexible working for men, given the rise of the remote husband, can also be to women's advantage as well.
And what about you, Alice? Are you team remote wife?
I guess I'm in a couple where we're sort of both flexible wife, flexible husband. So we both can work from home and do go into the office quite regularly. Right after this, I will keep my tape recorder on and go and record Money Talks, which I will be doing from home. So I can do bits of my job from home, but I should go into the office sometimes and go and chat to people.
Equality. I love it. Alice, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Ari.
If you head into the waters off Canada's west coast and drop a microphone, well, a hydrophone, over the side of the boat, you can eavesdrop on the conversations of killer whales. Some of these vocalizations, these clicks and whistles and calls, are used for communication, which is amazing enough. But get this, if you drag your hydrophone to other bits of North America's coastline, you'll spot different dialects, different accents even.
So these different killer whale languages are part of what researchers are learning about as they study the differences between populations of killer whales, called ecotypes, that live up and down the coastline of North America from Alaska to Southern California.
Dylan Berry writes about science for The Economist.
So there are other differences that exist between these populations. They look a little bit different. They come in slightly different sizes. Their coloration patterns are slightly different as well. But what's really interesting is that these populations have distinct cultural traits that differ between them. These include things like the languages, but also things like socially learned activities, including how they hunt, and even some of the ways in which they interact, social structure and play.
That's fascinating. These whales hunt in different ways depending on their ecotype.
Exactly. So around the world, killer whales are separated into roughly a dozen different ecotypes. So these are populations that are different enough to be distinguished, both genetically and on all kinds of other fronts, but they're not quite different enough to count as different species or subspecies. They're all apex predators, but they're usually separated by particularly their prey preferences. In the North Pacific, there traditionally have been three ecotypes that have been described in detail. So there's offshore killer whales. These get up to about 6.5 meters long, and they patrol deep waters in very large pods of between 100 and 200 individuals. And they hunt deep sea fishes and particularly are known to have a taste for sharks. There are then the resident killer whales. So these are a little bit larger, and they get up to about 7 meters in length. And they stalk the coastlines of particularly the Northeast Pacific between Alaska and Southern California. They hunt in pods of around 25 individuals. And they also eat fish, but they target shallow water coastal fishes, particularly salmon. There's about five different species of salmon along that coast that they're known to target. And finally, there are what are called transient killer whales. And they're called transient because they are known to move both between deeper waters and shallow waters. They're the largest of these three ecotypes. They get up to about 8 meters in length. And like I said, they move both between shallow and deep waters. But whereas those other two ecotypes, the offshore killer whales and the resident killer whales, hunt fish, transient killer whales target marine mammals. So these include things like sea lions, which get up to the size of black bears. They also hunt dolphins, and even when they're a bit more ambitious, whales, including things like gray whales, which get up to about 40 meters in length, all kinds of species of porpoise, and even occasionally sperm whales. So because they're hunting marine mammals, these are much bigger prey species. Transients are known for some particularly brutal hunting strategies.
Intriguing. What do you mean by that?
Well, I'll leave the description up to the lead researcher on the project I recently wrote about, Josh McInnes, who's based at the University of British Columbia. He recently led a team that analyzed 261 sightings of transient killer whales that roam the waters of the Monterey Submarine Canyon off the coast of California around Monterey Bay.
The hunts are very coordinated. I mean, you get groups of 15 or more killer whales that search along the canyon, and they ambush the calves and mums. In the deep water, there's very little that the mum can do. The killer whales often try to tire out the mum by continually chasing them. Then they try to separate the calf from the mother, grabbing onto the gray whale's pectoral fins and flukes and dragging them away. And then, you know, once that happens, we get just brutal attacks where individuals will swim at high speed and ram the side of gray whale calves, usually hitting the rib cages as well as the lower jaw. And once the lower jaw is broken, it kind of makes it difficult for the gray whale calf to lift its head to breathe. So in that case, the killer whales have an easy way of trying to drown the calf. Well, these behaviors are highly coordinated. Killer whales from the entire group, we're talking from 6 months old to, you know, 30 or 40 years of age, take part in these hunts.
Okay, first of all, that is some pretty dark stuff. But secondly, just to be clear here, these ecotypes are distinguished by, in part, what you called cultural things. They're not different species. They're distinguished by the way that they hunt.
Exactly. So when we're talking about predatory species, often the strategies and techniques they use to hunt prey are instinctive. So they're sort of baked into the structure of their brains as they grow up. Killer whales, however, are different. They're much more intelligent, much more sophisticated. So we've observed in all kinds of populations how killer whales teach their young specific hunting strategies. So we know that these techniques are not instinctive. They're a form of cultural knowledge. They get passed from generation to generation. Now, killer whales, because they're so clever, are also innovative. So they change these strategies over time from generation to generation. That means these have often been honed and perfected over potentially hundreds of generations, over millennia.
In this case, different ecotypes of killer whales were kind of diverging from, say, a founder population into multiple ecotypes about 300,000 years ago. And transients were really the first to go. There was competition for a resource that could not sustain the entire population. And this is where we see this, what we call resource partitioning. And in that case, you got residents that eat fish, transients that eat marine mammals. They can coexist.
So killer whale ecotypes are this fascinating little universe of biological studies, and it was a lot of fun for me to kind of get to know them a little bit better. But there's still a lot that we don't know. What would be particularly helpful is more genetic data, so we can potentially track some of the population histories of these different populations, understand quite how separate they are, and whether there's been gene flow between them. And the more we know, the more we might discover that there's many more ecotypes than we currently understand. These discoveries are just in general a reminder that biodiversity is not just about the diversity between species, but also within them. And what was particularly fun to discover is that killer whales seem to exist in many more shades than just black and white.
Dylan, thanks very much for joining us.
My absolute pleasure.
That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. Let us know what you think of the show by reaching out at podcasts@economist.com. And we'll see you back here tomorrow.
World peace might feel kind of like a pipe dream, but what if I told you it's not? 2024 will see more than 50 elections around the world. And in some places, peace is actually on the ballot. One reason is because countries in Europe and Latin America have been experimenting with this thing called feminist foreign policy. Because right now, the way that we wage war and peace, it's kind of a boys' club. The new season of Things That Go Boom from Inkstick Media and PRX is coming March 18th. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.